Hanson for defendant Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Weeks before his scheduled trial on an indictment charging him with a firearm offense, Mr. Simpson provided notice that he intended to enter a guilty plea. Ultimately, in the same guilty plea proceeding, he also waived grand jury presentment and pled guilty to an information charging him with wire fraud. The district court allowed Mr. Simpson to remain out of custody pending sentencing, but unfortunately, he committed violations, and that release was ultimately revoked. Based on those violations, and notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Simpson timely pled guilty, the government refused at sentencing to bring the motion pursuant to subsection B of 3E1.1 for the third level reduction of acceptance of responsibility. The district court did not remedy the government's failure to bring this motion. This was procedural error. Mr. Simpson is entitled to resentencing. This is fundamentally a disagreement with respect to the proper interpretation of section 3E1.1, especially as recently clarified by the Sentencing Commission with an amendment that took effect after Mr. Simpson's sentencing, but obviously while his case was on direct appeal. In our view, the proper interpretation of 3E1.1 requires a two-step process. At the threshold in subsection A, the court determines whether the defendant has clearly manifested acceptance of responsibility, and unlike subsection B, this can be a wide-ranging inquiry. Surely a defendant who pleads guilty and accepts responsibility by doing so typically receives a reduction under subsection A, but application note 1 to 3E1.1 makes clear that a district court can consider a number of other things in determining whether the defendant merits the two-level reduction. That can include voluntarily ceasing criminal associations and conduct, paying restitution, surrendering, things of that matter. But where we disagree, and where we disagree with the district court's conclusion, is on step 2 in subsection B, again, as clarified by the Sentencing Commission with the recent amendment. That is an inquiry that looks only to the timeliness of the defendant's guilty plea and whether that will leave the government of the obligation to prepare for trial and thus also save the court's resources and the government's resources because of that timely plea.
We're at a bit of a disadvantage here because of the lack of objection, and so we don't have the government's reasoning or lack of reasoning, right? Does that sort of hinder how we can assess this?
I think we do have the government's reasoning for why it refused to bring the motion in this case. There's no dispute that Mr. Simpson timely entered a guilty plea. The Northern District of Iowa is unique in this regard that the court's trial management order sets forth a timeline that a defendant must meet to get the court to grant a B motion as far as when the defendant has to provide notice of the intent to plea. That's 21 days before the trial date. And then when the plea has to be entered, 14 days. And Mr. Simpson met those timelines. I think the government made clear that the singular reason why it was not making the B motion was because of the pre-sentencing release violations that occurred after the guilty plea. And I would agree that
and you're saying that's not, that can't be done.
Correct, especially as clarified by the Sentencing Commission with the recent amendment that makes it very clear that subsection B is, again, focused on the timeliness of the guilty plea and not the wide-ranging inquiry under subsection A.
You're saying that the post-plea conduct would be relevant for the initial acceptance of responsibility under the first step, under A. Is that your position?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. So our view is the government can't use the B motion to avoid litigating the issue under 3E1.1A, or the government could have alternatively argued that it was a 3553A factor that the defendant committed violations after his plea.
What about the plea agreement here? Isn't there a section in the agreement itself that says, I guess the parties are agreeing that the government can refuse to file this motion for the third level for any of the reasons stated in 3E1.1, which would subsume both A and B rationales?
that essentially cribbed the language in the plea agreement that you're talking about, Judge Kelly, cribbed language from the former, and I guess in effect at the time, the sentencing application note 6 that said that the government should not withhold the motion for any reason not identified in 3E1.1. And this court in Brockman, for example, said, well, that shows that a court can consider basically A factors when deciding on what the government should have brought the B motion. Our view is that that language is part of what the clarification was with respect to the amendments to the guidelines, because the Sentencing Commission struck that from application note 6, and in our view clarified and made clear that when it was saying 3E1.1, it actually meant 3E1.1B.
But, so, the plea agreement doesn't reference or limit it to B, right? Just to be clear.
That's correct. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Again, it basically summarizes that language from the former application note 6.
So what's your view on the impact of that provision? And maybe I'm hearing you say because the guideline has changed, that changes the impact of that provision, or does it?
I think it does. I think it's a clarification of the guideline itself, which in turn is a clarification of what should have been meant by the plea agreement. In other words, I don't think the plea agreement can override the proper interpretation of 3E1.1.
Well, I think that's kind of, it's an interesting question. Could the parties agree to something that's just contrary to the guideline?
And I don't think they can. I mean, I think...
Well, the government could limit its discretion in a plea agreement further than the guidelines do, right?
With respect to a guideline that's very, in our view, very specific, that it's only focused on the timeliness of the plea, I don't think that the government can do that.
So what's your view at changing from the plea agreement to our case law? Does the change in the guideline language overrule or call into question our previous cases? And if so, which one?
It does, and I will be candid, that's the biggest difficulty for Mr. Simpson, because for the court to consider the amended guideline, I persuade you that it was a clarification, and there's case law out there saying that if the amendment supersedes or overrules prior circuit case law, it's substantive, but not a clarification. But notwithstanding that, I do think it is a clarification, in part because the Sentencing Commission essentially said so in the reasons for the amendment.
Didn't it reference our Jordan opinion in the amendments, or am I mistaken? And if so, where does that leave us?
It did. So the circuit the Sentencing Commission identified the circuit split and said that it was making an effort to clarify that, and essentially quoted a statement from Justice Sotomayor in the Longoria case, imploring the Sentencing Commission to issue a clarification on 3E1.1B, cited the Jordan case and said, well, we're going with the circuit.
So is Jordan overruled? I mean, where are we left? And if so, what part of Jordan is?
For Mr. Simpson to win, I think the court has to conclude two things in his favor that are contrary to Jordan. One is that, as I said before, the B motion has to be limited to whether the plea was timely. And Jordan and Brockman say otherwise. Two, Jordan and Brockman also say, use the Wade standard for whether the government can be compelled to bring the motion for downward departure for substantial assistance, and there the defendant has to show an unconstitutional motive. We're not alleging an unconstitutional motive here, but we think with the clarification, the Sentencing Commission is saying that 3E1.1 is different from 5K1.1. The government has more discretion with respect to
substantial assistance. So if the panel agrees with you and wants to reach that result, can we do it, or is it limited to the en banc court?
If this court finds that it's a clarification, I think the court can, but I also have to concede the court has said that if an amendment changes circuit precedent, it's substantive. So
it's a close one. So that's a fairly tight call in your mind.
Yes, sir.
I understand where you want to stand up. Okay, thank you.
If I may, I reserve the remainder of my time for vote. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Please report. district court's sentence in this case because it did not err in declining to order the government to move for the third level. Here, the standard of review is plain because as the defendant in Jordan, this defendant did not preserve his objection with regard to withholding of the third level. In this case, instead of objecting to the government withholding the third level, the defendant moved for a downward variance. And as such, because he did not argue that the government withholding the third level was error, this court should review this case under the plain error review. As discussed in our brief, the Congress, through the PROTECT Act, amended Section 3E1.1B to include the language upon a motion of the government. And as cited in our briefing, as substantively briefed, the Supreme Court has interpreted that language in a similar section, 5K1.1, and determined that it's in the government's discretion.
Well, what effect does the plea, that may be true as a general matter, but what effect does the plea agreement have on that, where the government enters into certain promises, arguably binding itself to the text of this, of the guidelines and saying, look, we're limiting what may be unfettered discretion to this particular definition. Doesn't that change this from a, whether or not the government, you know, the court has the authority to issue it? In this case, the government said, here's what we're promising you.
I think it's still in the government's discretion because the government's reading of the plea agreement didn't bind the government. The language reads, the United States may withhold the motion.
But on the following factors, which implies on the following factors only, arguably.
I suppose there are two ways to read it, the way that you have identified, or the other way. This isn't couching our discretion, but it is essentially identifying that one of the ways that the government could use its discretion is to withhold it based upon the kind of the hortatory language of common.
Isn't the argument here that the government withheld it based on factors outside the guideline commentary? I mean, I think that's what the argument here is.
The government withheld the objection, withheld moving for the third level, yes, based upon the defendant's post-plea comment.
And the defendant's argument is, look, that's not in the commentary language. You said you would limit it to the commentary language. You didn't do it. Therefore, you know, the government should be compelled to honor its agreement. And maybe I'm oversimplifying things. I find it to be a challenging issue.
Well, there's kind of two sides of that. The first being, as discussed in Jordan, and I believe in Brockman, there's an independent basis under 3E1.1. Yes, there's the preparing for trial, but then there's also the resource allocation. And so the government having to expend its resources, not only having to essentially at a revocation hearing.
And do you think that survives, that basis survives the amendment to the change to the guidelines?
Yes, because the guideline didn't, the guideline only defined the term preparing for trial. As this court has held in Jordan, and I believe in Brockman, it has identified an independent basis, preparing for trial and the resource allocation.
It seems to me though that the, as you read it, but thereby permitting the government to avoid preparing for trial, which is the phrase that the commission has now defined, and permitting the government and the court to allocate their resources. And if that were an or, I think you'd be on more solid ground. Then you'd have an independent basis, or permitting the government and the court to allocate their resources. But doesn't it seem to be linked, the resource allocation and the preparation for trial, just by the language of the guideline?
I understand your question, but I think you have to go back to the Jordan opinion.
I think now that we've got an amendment, we're now post-Jordan, really, in terms of the language of the guideline, but
in Jordan, I identified the two independent bases with the preparing for the trial or the resource allocation, because that's what Jordan addressed, was the resource allocation.
But your colleague on the other side has suggested that the guidelines effectively challenged the findings of Jordan. It's arguable that it challenged both those bases in Jordan and said, look, under subsection B, there's one issue that should be at play, and the issue is preparation for trial. And so to the extent that calls into question Jordan, why doesn't it call into question both of the different bases in Jordan?
Because the as the new 3E guideline, it only defines the term preparing for trial, which was the one basis. It didn't touch the second basis, the resource allocation. You know, clearly the commission could have defined both terms and united them, as Jake Kelly's question was getting at. But it didn't. It chose to define preparing for trial, and it didn't address the resource allocation. And I think in so doing, it doesn't upset the whole in Jordan and in Brockman and in that line of cases.
And is it your position that the post-plea conduct is a factor that could be taken into consideration under subsection A, just whether you get the acceptance or responsibility reduction at all?
Yes.
So I think I think one of the things that makes this case really difficult for me is I'm wondering if it's a bit, I don't know if it's a one-off, but it seems to me that the commission was probably not anticipating a situation where the government concedes acceptance of responsibility, which means that they agree that the person clearly demonstrates responsibility for his offense, but then is using the very factors that go into that decision to deny the first level. And so we're in a situation where those two things don't match up. Can you address that? It seems to me that this is a factual scenario that is forcing us to make some interpretations of the guidelines that just no one anticipated on the commission when they were making one, issuing, writing the guideline to begin with, but then secondly, making the amendments that they did.
Yeah, I think that at least in part, that issue is addressed in Brockman. Towards the end of Brockman, it discusses that kind of the interest identified in 3E.1, it makes no distinction between the two subsections.
But aren't you presenting to the district court as the government two very almost colliding positions under A and then under B?
Meaning, as part of the sentencing agreement, agreeing to...
they're inconsistent. You're saying to the district court, and I really want to hear your thoughts on this, because you're saying to the district court, yes, we agree that this particular person has accepted responsibility as that term has been defined under the guidelines and under subsection A. Oh, but under subsection B, we think he's done something that reflects a lack of acceptance of responsibility, so we're going to use that in subsection B to not do the extra level.
I think that goes back to the kind of the weight line of cases in terms of the government's discretion in terms of whether to move for the third level. But it also, as pointed out in Brockman, you can imagine the case where the government objects to the initial two levels and the district court grants it.
But here you didn't.
Right. I guess what I was saying is the government has the discretion for the third level in both cases, whether it agrees as part of a sentencing agreement, like this case, to afford the defendant the two levels but withhold the third, or in a scenario as addressed in Brockman, the court gives the two levels and the government, based upon the same conduct that it was objecting to for the two levels, still withholds the third level. And so I think that goes back to the government has the discretion in terms of whether to move.
To take inconsistent positions, essentially. That's part of the discretionary, the discretion that's been granted to the government to take inconsistent positions on it?
Well, it's not necessarily inconsistent because on the one hand, because it goes back to the resource allocation, the independent prong of 3E1.1b.
Well, yeah, and if that is a separate one, I see your point. But if it's about acceptance of responsibility, that's the sliver I'm kind of focused on here.
But I understand
your point about the separate justification.
And that's the government's position here, is that it is a separate kind of prong there. You've got the preparing for trial and the resource allocation as addressed in Jordan and Brockman. And so it wouldn't necessarily be inconsistent to withdraw its objection to the two levels, but still not move for the third level. One, because the government has discretion, but then two, because of the resource allocation that the government believes is independent of the preparing for trial. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. address the resource allocation point briefly. We view that as taking the language of B out of context. It's clear from the guideline itself. The commentary and the background information is talking about preparing for trial. When somebody pleads guilty early, it allows the government to allocate the resources.
Is that specific question en banc only?
I don't believe so, because I think it's a
fair question. Enough. Okay.
And given my time is up, I'll ask the court to reverse the amendment for recess.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you also, Mr. Edwards. Court will take the case under advisement. Do we have one additional case?
Yes, Your Honor.
United States versus Terrell Gaston.